Hello there, and welcome to YAO Session 8. I am your host, Riley. Unfortunately, we are only joined by one other person for right now. My horrible, just reprobate of a brother, Cameron.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm afraid we only have him. But we will have a guest showing up later on.
Yes, we will. It will be George Earth of Switchblade Symphony, Red Elvis's Sunshine Blind, and a bunch of other things. He has done a variety of trailer songs, including one for The Amazing Spider-Man. So he's also a comic book artist and a talk show host.
Yeah, he has a very varied career. We're going to ask him some questions about that. Hopefully get some amazing details that will make you laugh, cry, and either want to commit suicide or find the life, the love of your life. You messed up my mind. So, until then, we're going to be talking about... It's weird because we've had guests pretty much every week before now.
Yes. So, we're staring at a microphone.
It's like an actual radio show now.
And it's like, and all the people are waiting for us to come up with our next witticism.
It's exactly,
but at the same time, they're watching for us to stumble.
It's exactly like the King's Speech. I can tell you that. I'm honestly dressed up like I'm from, you know, 1920 right now. So, speaking of topics, Cameron, do you have anything in particular we should go over first?
I just saw Cleopatra at the Science Center.
Kind of. So did I. I was there too.
You were.
I was.
Yes. If now I'm a big enthusiast of history and of exhibits.
All right.
This one had its pros. It had big statues and lots of interesting archaeological finds. But I also found an air of pretension to it.
All right. Look. Here we go. Here's what we're gonna get into here, and that is. The art of making an exhibit that isn't complete shit.
It wasn't that bad.
I know. I'm saying these are basic rules. I'm not talking about Cleopatra specifically. You don't have to pick over every single word I say, you know. My point is that there is an art to presenting science, which I think is very often overlooked, and this is a good example of it. In case you don't know, There has been the Cleopatra exhibit has just opened at the Science Center.
We just pointed that
out.
Yes,
I know. I'm going into greater detail if you'd let me.
The subtitle seems to allude to the fact that they've uncovered the true story of Cleopatra. What they've actually done is uncovered new artifacts, but that's the implication.
Here's the thing about here's the way it's presented. You have a series of artifacts that were found underwater off the coast of Egypt, I believe. And they're apparently evidence of... They're new evidence in the life of Cleopatra. And they've given us grand new revelations into her life, which they are eager to show us, and that's what the exhibit is about. Here's the problem. The problem is... No. There are new artifacts, yes, but as with all archaeology, it comes down to it's given us new things that we think might have happened.
But then they say, this definitely happened.
That's the thing, is you can't present, oh, well, we think this happened. So it goes into, like, oh, it's see, the way it's presented is they have, like, this phone or whatever. You see, you go in, they show you an introduction movie. That talks about Cleopatra is a mystery that no one understands. But we have finally broken through the barrier.
I found it very cheaply produced and unconvincing.
If you've seen any specials on the History Channel about history, which I know is a rarity these days, if you have, then you have a good idea of what it looks like. Vignette-y and with very cheap costumes. They give you the intro, it's like, the mystery of Cleopatra. And then you go into the exhibit. And then they give you these... If you've ever gone to an art exhibit, you know that they give you those little earbud things, those headphones.
They give you, like, one of those huge cell phone-type hearing aid things. thingies in this one.
Yeah. Then, no, with this, they don't give you that. They give you a phone.
Yeah, I know. It's like those hearing aids.
Not a hearing aid. It is a phone. They literally give you a phone to walk around with. So you're walking around with a phone in this dimly lit room full of these ancient statues.
New age music playing on the speaker.
You know, new this sort of like light, wavy music playing in the background. And on the phone, and it's not... Usually when you go to these exhibits, you'll have someone say it's like, this was discovered off the coast of Zimbabwe in 1832. It's like, no. With this, they opted for a more theatrical approach. And here's where it falls apart. Your guide is someone playing the role of Cleopatra, telling you what's going on. This is a problem for a lot of reasons. You see, the thing about archaeology and science in general is that, one, it's important you know exactly what it is you're looking at. Am I wrong? When you're looking at a statue, you don't want to hear, "I am Cleopatra. In the ancient times, statues were very important." It's like you want to hear, okay, this is the statue, this is where it was discovered, and this is what we think is the importance of this statue and what it was for.
There's no vagueness to that. See, it's specific.
You need vagueness, because that's what makes archaeology interesting. Archaeology is interesting because of the mystery. That has always been the draw of archaeology. And a lot of science. It's the not knowing part. The problem with this, and with a lot of presentation of science, is it's presented as... mostly with history. Mostly with the way history is presented. Especially with stuff like the History Channel is... this is what happened. Or, I don't know. Honestly, I haven't watched the History Channel in a while, so I might be talking out my ass. It's one of those problems where you lose that draw, that mystery, which makes archaeology and history so engaging. And it becomes this schlocky... Icky thing.
Okay, no, actually, my main problem here is that the whole draw of the exhibit seems to be, we've uncovered the smear campaign by the Romans, and we've come to tell you the truth, not what the Romans have depicted her as, which is a seductress who is slimy.
The problem is that that's pretty much what they say in the exhibit,
too. They pretty much affirm it.
Because that's the only information we have. They reaffirm what's already been said because that's the information we have. The problem is that just now they're saying this is what's true, not this is what the Romans said. That's the problem with this sort of depiction of archaeology.
Anyway, the lesson to take away from all this is that you should go to history exhibits and learn things. However, exhibits are as open to criticism as any other thing that exists.
That's the big thing, is that... presenting history is an art unto itself. It's not just good because it's history. It can be really terrible.
It wasn't terrible.
It wasn't. It was Cameron, okay. I'm trying to present my view on things. Not say this is terrible. I'm saying that things can be terrible.
Yeah, but you're creating an association. Anyway.
Shut up. The point is that you have to present things in a way that maintains the integrity of the material being discussed. When you're presenting biology, you have to present it the way you would present it to someone trying to go into biology. You know, you wouldn't... It's like, that's the problem with all these exhibits, and with a lot of education going on right now, is it feels like they're trying to almost, like, sucker people into liking science. You know? It's like they dumb everything down to the point of it being completely useless. You know, do I need a dramatization of Cleopatra to learn about ancient Egypt?
I saw a dramatization that taught me about Cleopatra. It was directed by Cecil B. DeMille, and I think she was naked in a tub of milk. She was also Claudette Colbert.
Maybe if they had her naked in a tub of milk, this exhibit would have been better.
Anyway,
it's just a thought. The point is that to present art, To present history, to present anything, you need knowledge of what went into it and how it is processed. And this is an example of somebody not knowing anything about archaeology and trying to present it.
Oh, that's presumptuous.
Whatever, it is. It's true. You know it's true.
I know somebody like that must have been involved with money. Anyway.
Speaking of money. I'm sorry for that dead space. I was just accosted by my co-hosts. We're going to go to the next song. I think we're going to talk a little bit about upcoming movies. Just a little bit.
We have a different thing. Oh, sure.
Who knows? Changing tides and all that. We're going to go on to the next song. Cameron, would you like to introduce it?
This is Into the Void by Nine Inch Nails. I figure since our guest was involved with the Nine Inch Nails cover thing, it would be fitting.
All right. So
this is my favorite Nine Inch Nails song.
Well, see, you've learned something about Cameron.
Yes.
See you in a minute. Thank you.
myself, but myself keeps slipping.
And we're back.
Yes. Now let's talk about movies. What about that there? The third entry of one of the biggest franchises in the world, Diary of a Wimpy Kid, is coming out.
I know. I personally, the second one where he kills the mayor of the town.
Yeah, I found it a little portentous.
I think it's the fourth one. Hudson's our resident Diary of a Wimpy Kid expert. He's informing us that it is in fact a quadrilogy.
I only read the books.
So if it is a quadrilogy, that's amazing because that means it has subverted public view for so long. No, but in all seriousness, let's go on to... We already talk about movies. I don't want to talk about the actual movie,
however,
partially because we haven't seen it.
Skyfall is going to be a good Bond movie.
Goddamn, Cameron, trying to keep us on
topic.
It's
going to be so much better than
Quantum
of Solace.
Shut up about Skyfall. Shut up.
So much better.
So, Batman, The Dark Rising of the Return. All right.
Worst movie ever.
I don't want to talk about partially we can't talk about the movie because we haven't seen the movie.
I've seen it in my head. I can assume.
Here's the thing I
want to
know. Here's the thing I want to know. The movie, whatever. I hear it's pretty good. What I want to know is what's up with the reactions to the movie?
Well, first you have, let's see, there are three major components. There's the fanboy reaction to people who don't like it, either threatening them with death or deciding not to see it because it could be too disappointing. There's the reaction from Rush Limbaugh.
I know, it's like, that seemed more like one of those little things that's
I'm very curious as to why he didn't wiki it. I'm very curious.
It's like Bane has been in comics since the 90s.
It couldn't have gotten one of his staff people to wiki Bane?
Maybe he should have gotten the staff guy who was busy saying it was a setup.
All right,
here's the thing. First of all, when it comes to death threats, I just want to say death threats are a dime a dozen on the internet.
Honestly,
I don't think they should be taken... This sounds kind of weird, but I don't think they should be taken as seriously as they are.
I agree.
Everyone gets death threats.
I agree.
Everyone. If you have an email account, you'll probably get at least one death threat in your life.
But, I mean, like... I don't know, it's a little like a YouTube comment. It's like everyone has lost their intelligence. It has exploded.
Whatever. I can deal with that. What kills me is how, like, professional people are responding. Like, people who are, like, professional reviewers, professional movie-watching people, whatever. It's really polarizing for some reason.
Not really. The opinions of the people who dislike it are just, it's not that great.
No, not in that the people who dislike it really dislike it. In that it seems like everybody expects everyone to like it. It's like more so than the Avengers. And everybody was like, the Avengers is fun. You know? Like, that was one thing where it's like everybody's like, man, this is fun.
Not A.O. Scott, and he's entitled to his opinion.
Whatever, that's
honestly.
Cool. But it feels like this movie, every time there's a review that's not, it was, you know, the greatest thing since Ben-Hur, it seems to incite this level of vitriol.
Well, A.O. Scott did get vitriol. The difference is there are more people who seem to dislike this movie.
That's what I'm saying. Maybe it's just because there are more people and it's created sort of a storm. You know?
Well, yeah, I mean, The Dark Knight is allegedly one of the great films of all time. According to some people, I thought it was good. I didn't think it was...
I love The Dark Knight. I just don't get why every movie in the series has to be. I mean, nobody... Here's the thing. It's like nobody's defending Batman... What was it? Batman Begins?
People are defending that.
A little bit, but it's like nobody's like, that was the great movie of our time.
No.
Yeah. I mean, when that came out, I remember... Maybe I'm wrong. I remember the reaction being somewhat along the lines of,
No, the reaction was, oh, wow, it's a good Batman movie.
Yeah, but it wasn't like, this is the best thing ever, which it sort of was with The Dark Knight. The Dark Knight was like, this is amazing. But
no,
with Batman Begins, it was like...
The reaction was very positive.
It was. But again, it was positive in a normal positive sort of way, if that makes sense. with this, it seems like, why can't it be again? Why can't it just be normally good and some people can not like it again? Because I know people who don't like Batman Begins. And I don't... I honestly, I mean, maybe I'm wrong. I don't remember anybody having an issue with that back then. I mean, that movie that movie had its problems.
So did The Dark Knight.
Yeah, well, it had its problems, but it's still really amazing in every other way.
All right.
I don't know. One thing I want to get into is the way people take criticism on the internet. It's the internet, all right? That's something that has to be cleared out there. It's the internet. It's not that serious. It's just not. You're going to hear the worst stuff imaginable. But at the end of the day, it doesn't... You have to take it in stride. I don't know. Agreed?
No. You are completely wrong. Anyway.
I think we're going to go to another couple songs. We're going to be back in a minute. And then we'll be here with our guest.
Mm-hmm.
So, see you in a minute.
Yeah.
And we're back with Mr. George Earth.
Hi, guys.
How's it going?
Good.
So, George, would you like to... Can I call you George?
Yeah, and Lucy.
Well, George, and we're also joined by his dog, Lucy, who is, I swear, the, like, kindest dog in the world.
She is the
Despite
best dog.
Despite being massive.
Yeah, even though she looks like a dog that the police would send after murderers.
After they
escape from prison.
Yeah, that's true. She is the sweetest dog in the world. Unless she needs to, like, protect or something, then she gets... But even then, she's still very friendly.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. Give us a general overview.
Well, let's see. I've been playing music ever since I was a very small child. It took me a bunch of years to figure out what instrument to play, because I was picking up stuff ever since I could, even before I could remember doing that. There's pictures of me doing it when I was 2 and 3, going up to bands and bugging them to let me like play stuff. And but at 13, I started playing guitar. And then I quickly jumped into playing with a bunch of really great people where I was growing up in Santa Cruz, and started doing shows, you know, right about 15, 16 years old, and kept doing that for many years, and was in a bunch of different projects and made albums and
switched
to film.
Well, what would you describe your music as? Like, how do you see yourself?
I guess there's some sort of a thread that runs through all of it, but it's a lot of different types of music, so it's never been completely genre specific to me.
I have noticed, like, there's a lot of goth rock in your past.
Yeah, I don't know how that happened. I was totally not even aware. Like I was just telling you guys off mic before, when I fell into the trailer world, I didn't even realize that industry existed up until 2 years ago. Same thing with goth music. Like, I really didn't know what goth music was, and suddenly I was in Switchblade Symphony, and we were touring, and all the goth fans were really, you know, rabid is the word, but, like, you know, they were very, you know, enthusiastic and knew everything about all kinds of goth music, and assumed that I did as well, because I was in a big goth band, and I knew nothing about any of the bands. And, like, people would walk in with, like, a shirt. What was the shirt I used to always see that had, like, the radio wave patterns? Do you guys remember?
Had the waveform?
Yeah, what band was that?
Was that Joy Division?
It was Joy Division. Excellent. Good job. Good save.
I have my brother here.
Exactly. Joy Division. So people would come up with Joy Division. And that was death rock, right? That was, like, before goth music?
I don't even
know. Well, you knew the shirt. Anyway, I had no idea who the band was. And I remember, like, asking somebody at a show, like, oh, who is that? And they're like, oh, my God, are you retarded? You didn't know anything about this. You know, well, so I really didn't know too much about goth stuff, but I guess in that I like dark tones and, you know, dark sensibilities and a dark sense of humor, it kind of fits. And there's beauty in it. There's a elegiac, you know, quality. And so, but not necessarily by a specific choice of, like, oh, I like goth music. I kind of actually like hard industrial stuff of that vein even more than most of the...
What, like Nine Inch Nails?
Love Nine Inch Nails. Yeah. You know, Trent Reznor, huge influence on me.
Did you do some cover tunes of Nine Inch Nails, right?
Yeah, actually, Tina from Switchblade, she recorded on some of the early versions of Candy Machine that I had. That was Candy Machine 88. And we were on a few of the Cleopatra tribute albums. Cleopatra was big on doing tribute albums. And, so we were on the Nine Inch Nails one. I think we were also on Smashing Pumpkins one.
Hmm.
But yeah, so we did a couple covers on that.
Nice. We were talking a little bit before, like even before we started, about trailer music.
Back in the day before the show started. If you want.
Yes. 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 We go back very far.
Yes.
We're old friends from elementary school, which is weird because you're a lot older than me.
Yes, that's true. Hmm. It was a time warp.
We were talking about the industry of trailer music, which, honestly, I didn't even know those words fit together. Like,
yeah,
I just thought they all took the soundtrack from Requiem for a Dream and put it on there.
Well,
that's the end of it.
Funny you should say that, because that was kind of a big part of a big switch in trailer music. I think that sort of heralded... I'm speaking, you know, just from the little bit that I know, but that was one of the heraldings of it switching from the in a land where so and so and so and so. There was actually a marked shift between trailers being like that with that guy Don Fontaine or whatever his name was.
I did think it Don.
Yeah. And others that sounded like him, to being like these real hybrid orchestral music with almost no voiceover except for the dialogue from the movie, you know? So that was kind of a big shift in that industry. But yeah, I didn't know anything about trailer stuff specifically up until just falling into doing it. And but I do remember a point a few years back when the movie Nine was coming out, the animated movie.
Oh, yeah.
Nine. And I remember seeing the trailer for it, and the trailer was Coheed and Cambria's Welcome Home. And it was this amazing song, and I so wanted to see it in the movie. And I went to the movie thinking, like, oh, that scene where that song comes on is going to be so cool. And, you know, all through the movie, the music, you know, was not that, I mean, it was okay, but it didn't jump out at me. And Coheed and Cambria wasn't anywhere in there, and it was where I kind of made a note of, like, oh, wait, that's right, the songs that they use for trailers are not necessarily the things that are in the movies, and in fact, they, you know, almost hardly ever are.
If you've, with a few exceptions. If you've never seen the short film version of Nine, I would highly recommend.
I did see it, yeah. I did see it, yeah. Mm. It was pretty amazing. It's amazing, you know.
Guy's coming out with new stuff. He's a cool guy.
What about the short version of District 9? Did you see that?
Yeah, way back.
I've seen clips of that, but I haven't seen the full
what
thing
what he
yet.
Did with no money and just this little amazing thing. Yeah, we're really excited right now, actually, about, this was an unplanned perfect segue, but there's a really cool movie coming out called Elysium.
Oh, yeah, that's his next film. Yeah.
So, you know.
Are you working on the trailer music for that?
I may or may not be.
I hope you do. Well, it looks like a cool project.
It's the roulette of the art world, but I hope you strike it, because that looks like an awesome project.
Yeah, it definitely is. Yeah.
So how'd you get into trailer music?
Basically, I had been, you know, kind of on a perpetual search to do film stuff, and was always, like, hitting up directors and other, you know, some other composers, and I honestly don't even remember the exact specific thing that I must have sent out or answered to, but suddenly I got an email, which I often do, from, you know, people going, oh, we'll put your music and stuff, and I thought it was not, you know, a legitimate thing, but then I saw the list of the credits that he had for all the movies that he worked on, and I was like, okay, this actually seems like it's something legitimate, so I contacted him, and this is actually a weird story. If you guys went, let me say to the radio audience here that these guys went very deep in their research of stuff that I've done. Did you see any of the cheap comic stuff?
I saw a drawing on your website.
Okay, well, that's enough to link you in. I do a weird comic and video series, but he had actually first heard some of my music and went, oh, it's too Danny Elfman-ish, so yeah, it's not appropriate for trailers. And then he saw the comic thing and he was like, what the hell is this? And he, like, searched and watched some of the videos and went, oh, this guy actually has some other dimensions I didn't realize. And then he listened to some, I don't know exactly what he listened to, but some older industrial stuff that I did. And he was like, oh, this is kind of Nine Inch Nails-ish, and I think, you know, maybe he actually would be good to be trained to do trailer stuff. So
you're saying that you can do something other than one thing and it will help you in other areas of art?
It's funny, the comic thing has actually landed me a few gigs. It's so weird.
I think you're lying to me. Yeah. It's impossible.
So tell me a bit about the comic stuff, because, like, you don't just do, you also, you're a comic artist too, so, like, I'm wondering, is there something that crosses there between the music world and the comic world besides this job?
I wish there was. I mean, that's why, you know, if anybody from Adult Swim is listening, just, you should give me a show, because I would be perfect to do it. I would love to have a cheap comics world with my weird music in it. I think is awesome. I actually tried to do it a few times as, like, an animated thing. So far I've just done the two-dimensional animation, which is just like an object filmed moving around with my hand. But I would love to do that.
But tell me about your comics. Like, what are they?
Well, it's just kind of this weird world that I created called Cheap Comics. It was sort of based on this one character. It looks like a not a stick figure, but just a very basic figure, and he sort of became the protagonist in the situation, and then eventually another character was invented that was my id, In fact, all the characters are all bald with no other dimensions, but there was one character that had, like, curly hair, and that was supposed to be the comic artist, and the comic artist started being inside of the story and having a battle with the characters, and the characters eventually take over the comic, and so the comic artist just checks in occasionally, but the comic characters are kind of running their own very messed up, weird world.
Sounds very therapeutic.
Yeah, it is.
I do love when the self-insert is the villain.
And then there was another series, or a few little series that spawned off of that. There was a... these guys have pulled it up. That's from the actual... That's the drawn version, and then there's also the video version. The video version created some other characters. It was like a father and son, and the father was the worst father in the world, and the son is always asking him advice, and the father is leading him completely astray. If you search cheap comics on YouTube, you'll see those videos. But yeah, so I don't know where that came from. I love comic books. I was a huge, like, underground comic fan. And
that shows.
You know, one thing I have to ask when I look at that stuff is, have you ever seen any Mr. Freeman stuff? It's a Russian comic.
Wait, what is it?
Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Freeman, no, I have not.
I don't know. It reminds me of your style. It's a... whatever. Google it. It's really great.
Yeah, Mr.
I'll Freeman. Show you during the break. I'm breaking the fourth wall.
Yeah.
Actually, on that note, I think now's a good time to take another short break. We'll come back with some more topics.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds good.
All right.
Sure. Should we play Into the Sky by Switchblade Symphony or Venice, USA by Red Elvises?
It's your band.
I'd say Red Elvises.
All right. So, Red Elvises, we'll be right back.
Thank you. ocean and some sweet. Selfish look a little stone. Love to stop at silicone. Talking bullshit on the phone.
And we're back.
Hi, guys.
So, George.
Yes.
You got into trailer music through a combination of, I don't know, serendipity and raw talent. So,
yeah. And can you, comics.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Can you give us some of your experiences working in trailer music? Because I don't think it's anything that, like I said, it's something that's completely out of the public eye.
I just started doing it, but it's a cult that's shrouded in total secrecy, so I really can't talk about it. And that's partially true.
If you've signed yourself into any, you know, billion-year-old contracts, then that's cool.
It's definitely, I mean, it's awesome. It's I will say it's one of the most thought out musical processes I've ever been a part of in that, you know, taking something and thinking it to an extreme of like, where can this go and what can this do, as opposed to just, you know, doing things that just maybe come organically and stuff. And there's a certain organic element to it, but it's very much like, here is this thing we're going to do and go this way and do these things and have this feeling and make this feeling and oh, not that feeling and oh, you know, as opposed to just sort of being organic and, you know, so that's one definite. Interesting part of it that's different than, you know, playing in bands and making records like that and stuff. But it's really, you know, it's a fascinating process. And it's also a process of that some stuff, you know, is specific to things that are coming out, and other things are just in general that might be used for different things. So there's also, like, in some cases, kind of an open-endedness that goes with it. Like, oh, this could really go for this, or this could really go for this. In fact, a big part of, you know, what happens actually is, like, sort of checking it against other films and stuff to see how it, you know, how it paces.
So trailer music is sort of like, it is a bit more scientific, where you're going from the approach of this will make people feel this in this scene, and this will do this.
Yeah, I mean, it's an aspect of advertising in every sense of the word, obviously. So, but it's I mean, there's definitely a short time frame and certain emotions that you're trying to get, and certain things that don't work. But that's across the board in almost every big media thing. Mm-hmm. Like, honestly, after doing trailer process, I see it now in everything. I see it in advertising, I see it in just general media and what a company puts on a cover. Like, there's, you know,
it's a really big thing in design.
Exactly.
Where it's like every feature is planned out. You know, when you look at Avatar and you look at
exactly,
like, I always go back to Avatar when you look for something as an example of like a baseline of design efficiency.
Right.
It's like the Na'vi are like the pinnacle of design efficiency.
Right.
To fill their roles in that story.
Right. Have you heard the stuff about that he's like doing like.
He's doing like underwater
three
stuff.
Three movies at once.
Isn't he buying some other planet or something, or building a space?
Avatar funds his safaris or whatever.
It funds his underwater expeditions.
Yeah, I'm predicting he's gonna own like the outer space theme parks in the next couple centuries.
Hey, I'd go to an outer space theme park long as they cure bone degenerative disease.
Anyway,
but going okay, so. Can't talk about trailer music because you've been signed into the Illuminati. That's cool.
Yeah. I mean,
talk to tons of people.
I don't know that much about it, having just been thrown into it, you know. But
tell us about like what your first project was and like what you had to overcome with that.
shoot, it's really hard to say.
Well, you know, you're coming from. You know, a much more open kind of music to advertising. Yeah. So I'd imagine you're sort of shifting gears.
Yeah.
There.
Well, yeah. Let me think about. I was thinking about the overcoming part in a different way. I mean, like a big part of it was just, you know, again, being like really, you know, doing like a simple process that grows. I'm kind of used to sort of jumping in and I mean musically, like, you know, when I would play with the band, where I would just like jump in and kind of, it's like full blown and, you know, starting off at 10 and then pulling back at places, you know. But whereas, like, you know, a lot of trailer music was having to really, you know, learning how to play and write in this, you know, very small thing that grows and gets big. And so, but I love doing it. It's a cool thing. So that was something to sort of adjust to.
So you had to sort of learn how to write music differently. It was,
Yeah, definitely. You know, I mean, a definite different type of process. You know, but I still naturally do the other stuff that I do.
And well, how do you write music when you're not doing trailer music, or how did you write music before that?
I've always been a big fan of like improvisational recording. You know, and I kind of use that as my writing tool a lot of times, where I would just record and build that into the compositions that I was doing, and then, you know, in some cases totally elaborate on it, in some cases completely change it out, in some cases leave a lot of that there, you know, especially if I wanted to have, you know, any kind of lo-fi vibe or something. So that was, you know, and I still kind of do that a lot on my own, but, you know, trailer music and film music, and you know, probably every other kind of music except for what I do, is usually very thought out and stretched out and not that kind of process. So,
well, I guess it depends on where you're coming from, but if you can't talk about, you know, if you don't have any amazing, I'd imagine you have to have some stories coming from, you know, goth rock, because there's got to be, you know, something interesting would probably happen in that environment.
Oh gosh, there was a lot. I should be writing a book.
If interesting stuff happens in choir, I'm sure, I mean, interesting stuff happens in goth rock.
It wasn't really gothy. I mean, it was, you know, the stories were just funny because of, you know, of who they were, what was going on. Like us touring with Gary Numan.
really?
And being with Gary when he had his first taste of... actually, no, he didn't eat it. That's right. We were in New Orleans, or we were in Baton Rouge, and the club made us a crawdad feast, which was like, you guys know what crawdads are?
Yeah.
So crawdad feast with like all boiled all day, and they brew it in like beer or whatever, and they had corn on the cob there. And
that sounds like New Orleans.
And we tried to get him to eat it, but he wouldn't eat it because he was, you know, he only liked American hamburgers. That's pretty much my big goth story.
Really? The big goth story, Gary Numan likes hamburgers.
It wasn't like a drug crawdad, and it was just normal crawdads.
No, yeah.
No rebel. All right.
I met Trent Reznor that night, club. He came to see Gary Numan because he performs a couple Gary Numan songs, or he performs Down in the Park, performs one Gary Numan song. Oh wait, no, that's Marilyn Manson. Trent does something of Gary Numan's, I can't remember, but yeah, got to meet him there. And then I think we took a seafood feast and left it in a car overnight, and it got really hot the next day.
Seafood is really great when you leave it in the fridge for night.
But we digress. So, yeah, I mean, I have lots of goth stories. It was a crazy, you know, they were all really great fans. They were all really fun shows. The bands were always very enthusiastic. Those Switchblade got to tour with a bunch of really great acts. So that was always fun. We always loved the people that we were touring with, and, you know, tours were always a lot of fun, you know, both on stage and off stage. In fact, really, that was the reality of it, was that it was basically like a, you know, a 22-hour day, you know, minus sleep time, of just like totally having fun and traveling.
Well, and can you give us like an example? Like, what would be like an, I can't really say average, but like an average, you know, sort of day in the life of, you know,
in a
band.
Average day on tour, in a van was different than a bus. In the van, it was, in a lot of ways, it was actually more fun all the time. It was like, you know, wake up at 8 o'clock in the mornings at some hotel, hop in the van, because you have to do like a 10 or 12 hour drive or something, you know, some really long drive. Drive basically all day, stop at, you know, some different rest stops, get, you know, snacks and stretch, drive all day, get to a club, do sound check, get usually some food right then that's, you know, in the dressing room, have a, you know, few hours to get ready before the show, do the show, and then typically, you know, we would like hang out and have fun or whatever because we had a hotel somewhere that night, or we would maybe drive a short distance, but usually if you had a van, we were getting a hotel every night and then just having to leave the next morning. Most of the fun adventures I remember happened in that time between the show ending and having to leave the next day. But in a bus tour, it was different, because in a bus tour, basically, you just, you know, you woke up in the bus was already in some strange town at some strange club, you went inside, did sound check, did the show, stayed pretty late, couldn't really go anywhere because you had your bus there, or I got in trouble a few times going on adventures and trying to get back to my bus. And then the bus, like, leaves, and so, you know.
When you say adventures, you realize I have to ask you what you did.
Just usually what it was, there were so many great fans of that band that they always were trying to get us to go to, like, some after party. Will you guys come? And, you know, usually we didn't, but there were some times that we did, and they were all really, like, fun. And then it was always, like, kind of weird and uncomfortable because you're, like, on tour and suddenly at some, you know, come guys, come to our big party. Sometimes it was a party. Sometimes it was just, like, their apartment, and they have something playing.
They get out the ropes.
There's, like, four people gothed out sitting there going, oh, my God, Tina and George from Switchblade Symphony are here. It was usually me and Tina, the singer, were kind of notorious for disappearing and going off and having weird adventures, not, you know, not with each other or anything.
You know, I wasn't thinking that, but now I'm suspicious.
No, not at all. I was basically like her. I was sort of her guardian, and she was sort of my instigator, I think. Mm. But yeah, we were just kind of the incorrigible ones. The bus driver and our tour manager always referred to me and her as Cindy from the Brady Bunch, because when they would go on a road trip and they would leave Cindy behind. So, like, whenever we were, like, you know, at a rest stop, it always took us longer to get back into the bus or the van and stuff. And Cindy, we're going to leave you behind. So all we right. collectively were Cindy.
We're actually running a little short on time. Excellent. So I want to, yeah, actually, because usually we have, you know, I guess we're used to having a full, like, hour and a half to talk to people. It's like, but you were busy doing something beforehand. Can you talk about that, or should I veer away from that topic?
Of when?
Before you came here.
Oh, I was working on trailer stuff. Yeah, yeah, pretty much 5 days a week right now. I'm working on trailer stuff. So yeah, there's a bunch of cool stuff that's coming up. So yeah.
But if you said anything, then the lawyer ninjas would come and assassinate you in your sleep, and we don't want that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I have to ask a question because it's got to ask every person who comes in.
Yeah.
How did you get your first, you know, like, how did you get your place in the band? How did you get your, like, first real job in music?
Well, my first real job, I mean, it's kind of hard to say. I mean, I'm sure I did probably some paid gigs somewhere as a kid that I don't remember, but kind of my first big thing in music as far as doing anything was my band World Entertainment War got pretty popular in the town we were living in, and I started that band when I was, you know, pretty young, and then that band ended up getting a major label deal, and some crazy stuff happened after that, but that was kind of the beginning of my real large pro thing, although I was in a bunch of bands before that, but when I was how old was I? I guess I was about, I don't remember how old I was. I think I was in my early, I was 18 or in my early 20s, and the drummer and I started that band, the drummer Anthony Guess and I started World Entertainment War, when we met the singer Rob Bresny. Rob Bresny had the concept called World Entertainment War, and Anthony and I had a musical foundation of guitar and drums, and we started playing together and then became very popular Santa Cruz band and had a really fun run. And then we got signed to a major label and things got weird. And then the band broke up. And we were managed towards the end by Bill Graham, who is one of the most famous, like, rock and roll management guys. He, like, managed all the big 60s bands in the Bay Area and Northern California. And so we were managed by him. And then he died. And so we sadly miss him. But yeah, so that was kind of my first big thing. And then after that was Switchblade.
All right. I don't know. I'm trying to wonder because...
I'm sorry I haven't answered more of the... Go ahead and ask me anything you want about the film stuff. I'll tell you what I know. I don't know that much. And if I can't...
I don't want you to get you in trouble.
No, it's fine. It's fine.
What have you done? Besides, I know you did a TV spot for Spider-Man recently.
TV spot for Spider-Man was my first official big thing with the trailer stuff. I've done a bunch of other tracks that are floating around, and you know, in some cases were actually cut into films but didn't make it to the final trailer run. But there's a bunch of other ones right now. In fact, and that's where I can't go too much about that stuff. But there's also a bunch of other short film stuff that I've done recently. But I think we're getting some signal security
Oh, nothing. I'm just trying to make sure everything hasn't been ruined in technical side of things.
It's okay. Excellent.
Sorry. I don't know. It's weird because this is it's the music scene is always one of those things that seems to change from person to person, but some stories seem to remain the same. You get into music, have sort of somewhat creepy fans. You know,
most fans were not creepy. Most fans were really great. I mean, that's
most fans are great, but you always need like a few that are kind of creepy. It's just it's their job to be like that.
Yeah.
And then things get weird, and either someone dies or someone gets or band breaks up, and in this case, both.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the hardly any bands actually stay together forever, except for the Rolling Stones, and a few other ones. And then people die, so that is a common thing. But you know,
I've heard of that. It is. I don't know.
But yeah. Well, you know, some of the stories stay consistent to all bands. You know, depends too. If a band is only around for a short bit, they don't have too much history. But if they're around for longer, they have a different bit of history.
Yeah.
But
Cameron, do you have anything in mind?
What are your thoughts on digital distribution?
Wow.
Ooh, now we're getting serious.
Well, I remember back in the day when MP3.com was a big deal. I think it's awesome. I think that, you know, from the indie stuff that I've done that's truly indie, where I just like sold on CD Baby and stuff, almost all of the revenue I've gotten from that has been digital distribution stuff. So that's clearly like, you know, a good channel. That being said, I mean, I think that people should be able to share information. I mean, I like sharing information, and I respect if somebody wants me to buy something, but then I also might not be able to share it as readily. So I'm kind of torn on, you know, how I feel about, you know.
It is one of those problems. It is one of those, especially with music, because you have people who, I know there are a lot of indie bands who do, like, put out their stuff for free because to them it's, you know, free advertising.
Right.
You know?
Well, I think it's kind of like the radio. Like, I love listening to iTunes, you know, radio, and I hardly ever buy anything off of iTunes, and I'm down with the fact that they make all this music available for me to listen to, but if I want to own it, then I have to, you know, pay something. Sorry. So I kind of feel that way in general. Like, you know, for myself, I'd love anybody that wants to listen to anything I did to be able to do it, but I don't necessarily want them to own a copy of it if I'm not getting paid for it. You know, but in a lot of cases, I'm happy for them to own the copy just because they can, you know, enjoy it or do something with it.
I think it's one of those problems that sort of, I hate to step over you again, but it's like, it's one of those things where it sort of ties into the way music works, where music is sort of has its own community, its own sort of like, its own system of people. And it feels like most of the bands that get into the sharing their stuff for free are people who are really deep into that, where they have like a relationship with the people who listen to their music. And the feeling is sort of, you know, take our music if you want. If you want to give us money to do more stuff,
right,
give it to us.
Right.
And I think the main problem is you can't market that large scale.
Yeah, and that also, you know, most people are going to probably opt to the, well, let somebody else go ahead and be the one to give them money. I mean, yeah, I know I'm one of those
most
people.
No, most people do.
Usually, yeah.
It's
all right, then, like, where do you, like, what do you think of something like Spotify, where it's like people are listening for free, but in theory, the artist is still making money from it.
I think that's cool. Yeah.
It's all about making
no deep thoughts on Spotify.
Well, no, I'm kind of. I guess I didn't understand exactly how Spotify worked. Because wait, can I be making revenue off of Spotify somehow?
Switchblade Symphony's on Spotify. I think you are on Spotify.
Website of cell phone. Where's my royalties?
Yeah. Well, I don't get any Switchblade royalties. So it's not an issue.
It's music.
Yeah. Wow, awkward silence there. Too.
Well, yeah.
Tina, if you're listening, I still love you. Tina and I had a great post-Switchblade band. I don't know if you guys saw any of the Small Halo stuff, but Tina and I had a band called Small Halo that we really enjoyed that was up until just recently. That was kind of the last big musical thing I did right before starting the trailer stuff. So,
All right. I think it's about time we sort of wind down just a little bit,
mm-hmm.
get into our deeper questions. Yeah. We have to. Here's the thing: when we interview somebody, we need to know everything about them.
These guys just took a very sharp knife out of a little leather sack and placed it on the table.
Cameron just took out his silenced pistol.
Lucy, wake up, Lucy.
The dog won't save you. Just general questions.
Can we talk about my dog more?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Your dog.
Yeah.
When did you get your dog? Because that is the most amazing dog.
Well, she is a little over 2.5 months old. Actually, she'll be 3 on New Year's Day. And on January, February, March. Was it March? I'm going to get in trouble. I think it was March. Several years ago, she showed up at our front door drinking out of the cat's water bowl. She was 3 months old. And she was lost in the neighborhood. Friendliest dog in the world. And my girlfriend called me and told me. And I said, I love her so much. And she said, you haven't even seen her yet. But I knew that I would. And as soon as I saw her, she's a big love. That's the story of Lucy showing up.
Lucy, the half dog, half bear, yeah. half care bear.
Her favorite thing right now is going to the dog beach. We've gone to the dog beach we've gone a bunch this summer. We're going again on Sunday. We've gone like 3 times in the last 4 weeks.
You love your dog, don't you?
I do. I do love her, and she loves the dog beach. It's the best thing.
So, okay.
Go ahead. What was your intense?
I was going to ask you just general questions like, favorite band right now?
Oh God, that's always
song you hate the most because you can't get it out of your head.
I hate, there's a lot of stuff when I go to the gym. I hate everything that they're playing, mostly. And some of it I like, but some of it just, you know, I don't want to hear. There's days where I go and they don't put the stereo on it. It's the best thing in the world. It's so nice to have a silent gym. But, I don't begrudge anybody anything. But that song, I'm glad you came. I'm glad you were. It drives me nuts.
Well, you know, Jim's, what can I say? They're not renowned for their musical expertise.
Yeah. Mm. Favorite band, though?
Something you like.
Just right now.
Well, does it have to be current?
No.
I was trying to find my Bloody Valentine album to bring here. Loveless, I think, is, if I was going to be stuck on a desert somewhere, island or something, and I could only have one album, it would be Loveless.
Yes, great album.
My Bloody Valentine. Yeah. One of the greatest guitar albums of all time. Yeah. There's some off mic shenanigans.
Yeah, it's technical shenanigans. Okay. See, you're breaking the fourth wall again.
Sorry.
Now everybody's going to be like, this show is totally unprofessional. I'm never listening again. I am putting out a Yakuza death threat on these
guys.
Really,
we break the fourth wall every show. It's normal at this point.
You just won't leave me to my illusions.
Delusions is more like it.
So, okay, favorite band. What's next for Mr. George Earth?
Well, I'm focusing on expanding into doing... full movie scores. So, I mean, that's actually what I was planning on doing and got, you know, kind of directed into the thing of trailer stuff. But, you know, it's an awesome function. I'd be happy and lucky to do trailer stuff forever. But I want to do, you know, score stuff as well. So. And I've scored, you know, several short films and a few animated things. And so that was one thing I didn't really get to talk to you guys about, was one of the differences between film scores and film trailers is that film score follows picture and film trailer music leads picture. So there's a real difference between that, but I like doing both. So.
All right, so film scores. What film scores inspire you when you're doing your own work?
Well, what inspires me is, I mean, I take inspiration from different stuff, but, you know, I've always loved the score of Blade Runner. I love, There's a lot of movies that I just love the music that gets used in the movie. It's not necessarily the score, but like the movie, the music that gets placed in the movie. I love the stuff that I love Trent Reznor's stuff, like The Social Network, like really, you know, buzzy, beautiful, kind of quiety things. Really cool. A huge Angelo Badalamenti fan.
Oh yeah,
he did all the David Lynch stuff. And he used to be in a weird death rock band called The Birthday Party.
See, it all ties together.
The birth was that?
Yeah, it was Angelo Badalamenti was the bass player, and the singer was Nick Cave.
Yeah,
Cameron's just nostalgic to an area, to an era before he was born.
I didn't know he was in that band.
Yeah. One of my favorite film, I think David Lynch is just a god. He's so awesome, and the music that he picks, he's like one of the most amazing like music sensibilities, mm-hmm. and. The Lost Highway soundtrack. Movie was good. It was weird. It was kind of uncomfortable. It was good. But the soundtrack was just amazing and stellar. All the stuff that got picked for it, plus all the score stuff. Who else? Ennio Morricone. I love all of the television composers of the 60s and
like Jerry Goldsmith's early work.
Yeah, well, Jerry Goldsmith, and then all the like the Hollywood show TV show guys, and I'm forgetting their names, but like the guy that wrote all the like I Dream of Jeannie, and who was that? I'll forget the name. But that period, yeah.
So you're looking for a spot in the I Dream of Jeannie movie remake.
Yeah, that's right.
Exactly. You heard it here first, folks.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, anyway, so to go back to answer the question, definitely. Film music for scoring is still a huge fascination for me.
All right. In closing, any advice for, you know, up and coming musicians who want to be amazing?
Yeah, you know, just if you're doing it right now, it's you're doing it. You're already in there, and enjoy it and keep exploring and keep yourself open and. Somebody did say something interesting to me when I was younger as a musician. He said, I think I was up in arms about something I was doing musically at that moment. He was like, oh, dude, you know, the music you're going to be doing years from now is so totally different than what you're doing right now. Don't even trip out on what you're doing. And he was right, you know. So, I mean, so, you know, if you're going through any trials and tribulations with music, then, you know, just keep doing it. You're going to be a completely different person. And if you're not going through trials and tribulations and you're enjoying it, just keep enjoying it. But, you know, music is an important gift, not only for the people that can do it, but for the people that can't do it. So it's a responsibility that you have if you are doing it to at least give it a whirl.
All right. Wise words. Thanks.
Thanks for having me, guys. It was a lot of fun. Thanks so much. Lucy had a great time. And
sleeping.
Cool. And thanks, guys, again for doing such great research.
Right. And thank you for coming on.
Yeah. Awesome.
And that is it.
Goodbye.